Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we take you to Freeport for the annual Justice Lewis Skolnick Award from the Maine chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. The award recipient and speaker is attorney Walt McKee, the principal attorney of McKee Law of Augusta. This program also features Laura Murphy, lead lobbyist for the ACLU of Washington, D.C. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Sheena Bellows, Executive Director of the ACLU of Maine, will introduce Laura Murphy, and Attorney John Patterson, President of the ACLU of Maine, will introduce Walt McKee.
So one of my favorite parts of the Skolnick Dinner is the dose of inspiration that you walk away with. And Walt McKee certainly is one of my sources of inspiration when we're in the trenches in the legislature and things look grim. He's a tireless and passionate advocate for justice. But John gets to introduce him a little bit later. I get to introduce our featured speaker. And Laura Murphy has been a mentor for me and many young women who work at the ACLU. She's extraordinary. Laura, I asked her how her week had been. And she said, well, first I had to moderate a congressional briefing around the Arizona SB 1070 law, and then we were testifying before Congress on cyber spying and also the Victim Rights Constitutional Amendment, and the list goes on and on. Laura, as lead lobbyist for the ACLU, was extraordinarily influential in the passage of the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010, which reduced the crack powder cocaine disparity. She has been working on the End Racial Profiling Act for over a decade and a key advocate for that on Capitol Hill. You may have heard her on National Public Radio advocating on national security and civil liberties issues. You may have seen her on the Today Show recently talking about contraception and women's rights. It is my great honor to introduce my former boss, Laura Murphy, Director of the Washington Legislative Office.
Thank you, Shenna. When Shenna came to the Washington office, she was a field organizer, and one of her tasks was to help organize people around the country against the Patriot Act. And we got people riled up in city councils and state legislatures, and she had an awesome record. She was one of the top organizers in the Washington Legislative Office. And when she said she was going to apply for the ED position here at Maine, I tried very hard to talk her out of it. But when I look around and see that this is a sold-out dinner, I see that she made the right decision. And you're so lucky to have her, and I was so fortunate to be inspired by her work as a young woman and to see her grow and to see this dinner grow and to see the board so strong. It makes me very, very proud to have been part of her life. So thank you very much, Shenna. I'd like to thank you all for coming out tonight. I'm the substitute. I don't mind being called the substitute. Anthony's in Guantanamo. But the ACLU of Maine is very, very important because it's a bellwether kind of state. I mean, your legislature goes from Democrat to Republican. Your congressional delegation does the same thing. And so Maine is a place for us to watch. So it's one of the most important affiliates in the nation. As goes Maine, so goes the country. And that couldn't be more true in this election year, because the replacement for Olympia Snow may be the person who decides whether or not the Senate is Republican-controlled or Democrat-controlled. And so, you know, it's going to be a very, very interesting race in Maine and many eyes in Washington, not all eyes, but many eyes, mine, are on this Maine Senate race to see who you deliver to Washington. I would like to thank and recognize Justice Lewis Skolnick, for whom this fine dinner is named. Justice Skolnick is the founder of this affiliate, and he's an inspiration to civil libertarians everywhere. So I'd like to thank him again for this Ophelia. And I'd also like to congratulate Walt McKee. He's a criminal defense attorney. My oldest brother, Billy, is a criminal defense attorney. And he's one of the reasons why I worked for the ACLU. We had these huge fights. My father was a judge, like Justice Skolnick in Maryland. And my brother took over his practice when my father got elected to a judgeship in Baltimore. And they had this terrible debate. My father had a workman's compensation practice, and my brother wanted it to be a criminal defense practice. And my brother was saying, you know what, if the law doesn't apply to the least of these, what good is the law? What good is the Fourth Amendment if it's not applied in low-income communities? And so he was 12 years older than I was, and I was sitting there at the dinner table watching the clash of the titans. It's one of the reasons I was so inspired to join the ACLU. And then my father represented his brother before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And so we had grand debates about the First Amendment. And as I was flying up here, I remembered that I had a connection to Maine. I went to summer camp here twice. But also, my great-grandfather was a man named Amos Noe Freeman, who founded one of the first black churches in Portland. And I've been planning with my nephew for years to come up here and research him. He housed a lot of African Americans in the Underground Railroad who were escaping Jim Crow and slavery in the South. And so I need to come to Portland, but I don't have much time to do anything except work for Shenna on this trip. So Walt, I want to say congratulations to you, because Shenna has told me how important your advice and counsel has been to defeating several bills in the state legislature. So I've told you about Shenna. I've thanked all the people who are responsible for this dinner and the staff of the Maine affiliate. I want to just talk to you a little bit about Washington and its relationship to Maine. I think there's been a lot of hope lost in Washington, D.C. So I'm going to pick on the president just a little bit, but I'm also going to try to give you a picture of what the climate is in Washington. The president's personal favorable ratings are still high, but politically, he is being harshly criticized by both his own party and the Republican Party. When I talk to my friends on the progressive side of things, he's a civil liberties disappointment. He hasn't closed the prison at Guantanamo Bay. He's embraced a targeted killing program that lets him terminate U.S. citizens without court review. He's claiming military authority to detain people in the United States without charge or trial. He's refused to prosecute intelligence and military officials who engaged in torture. He continues many of the invasive surveillance and wiretapping policies of the Bush years. Even on health care reform, some progressives don't think he went far enough. Then when I walk over to the other offices, the conservative, the Republican offices, people like Joe Wilson, who screamed, "You lie," during the State of the Union in 2009, they're not happy either. They think that Obama is a cross between FDR and Jimmy Carter, who's a tax and spend socialist liberal, expanding the welfare state and saddling our grandchildren with debt. The gun owners are furious over, fast and furious. He's accused of lining the pockets of some of his environmental friends through the Solyndra scandal and partying like there's no tomorrow with the General Services Administration. And the Secret Service is not just using prostitutes, it's refusing to pay prostitutes a fair wage. And so the Republicans aren't happy with President Obama either. But I tend to take a long view, because I've been lobbying since 1979. So I think there's some things to observe about this president. He is the most LGBT-friendly president in history. He has protected health care coverage for contraception and is working on an executive order to institute some equal pay reforms for women. He's challenged all of the laws are related to immigration and try to impose Arizona-like and Alabama-like immigration laws. His Justice Department has challenged all of them. He's used the Voting Rights Act and other laws to challenge voter suppression measures like the ones you've experienced in Maine on same-day voting, but ones in South Carolina and Georgia and Texas. He has rebuilt the civil rights divisions and infrastructures in the Department of Justice and the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Education. He's challenged police practices in 19 cities, and because of police violence and brutality and racial profiling. And then, you know, he's dealt with that business having to do with a terrible recession, an oil spill in the Gulf, two wars, Osama bin Laden, and expanding access to health care. So the people in Washington are very divided about the president, so we're all looking toward the election. So I'm working in a cynical place. When people say, how can you do that work? John just asked me, how do you do the work you do in Washington? Because I'm an optimist, and because you're optimists. Hope is us. I suggest to you that if you're looking for hope in a candidate or a public official, you're looking in the wrong place. Whether it's Reagan's promise of morning again in America or President Obama's change we can believe in, those are slogans, not measures of accountability. So if you're looking for hope in President Obama or candidate Romney, you're setting yourself up for a letdown. Real hope comes from us. It comes from Americans of all political stripes who care enough about freedom and liberty to take action. It comes from activism, the kind that Shenna knows deeply about. It's funny, one of the knocks I hear against President Obama is that he's a radical like the late Chicago inner city activist Saul Alinsky, who might be familiar to some of you in this room. Although Alinsky wrote a book, Rules for Radicals, he was really anything but. He was an activist like us, and his constant refrain was to work within the system. He recognized the activist's true source of hope. He said back in 1972, my only fixed truth is a belief in people, a conviction that if people have the opportunity to act freely and the power to control their own destinies, they'll generally reach the right decision. I think that particular sentiment sums up the ACLU perfectly. If anything, this organization has an abiding belief in the hope that rests in a free people. So as long as we have the right to think, the right to be private, the right to vote, the right to dissent, the right to love, and every other right that everybody in this room gets up in the morning and goes to sleep at night fighting for, we have hope. And we should embrace the hope that comes from our activism. More importantly, we should put all of our energy into that activism and into the ACLU. All governments inevitably disappoint, but the ACLU serves no political master and works ceaselessly to help keep government accountable. We're doing an amazing job at that, and no one is doing a better job than the ACLU of Maine, and I applaud all of you. So what is the ACLU? It's worth taking a step back and thinking about what we do. What is the ACLU? What accomplishments can we point to as a source of our hope? We are 650,000 people strong. We have affiliates in every state. We don't just talk about civil liberties, we sue. We lobby, we organize, we are boots on the ground. We fight for a more equal and just society. We fight for those who can't fight for themselves, like the man with cancer who is undocumented and needs access to your state's healthcare system. We fight for kids who are bullied. We fight for teenagers who can't get legal and safe abortions. The Washington office has been in the forefront and been central to the campaign to ensure that religious dogma doesn't deny women access to birth control. We thought we'd won birth control years ago, but here we are again, fighting again for birth control. 3 weeks ago, we brought 18 retired four-star generals, colonels, the first woman helicopter pilot to lobby for the right to get abortions paid for women who are victims of sexual assault in the military, who are victims of rape and incest. Do you know every other restriction in the law allows an exception for rape and incest except the military? So if you're in the federal government and you work for GSA, you can get your abortion covered if you're a victim of rape or incest or your health is endangered. Women serving our country or women dependents of men serving our country can't even get abortion coverage in the case of rape and incest. So we brought the generals to Washington, D.C. to meet with Harry Reid and to meet with other senators, Senator Levin from Michigan, and we think we'll get that small pro-choice measure through this Congress if Harry Reid doesn't try to play politics with it. We fight for religious minorities who face profiling and infiltration by the FBI. Right now, the Washington Legislative Office is leading public education around the issue of FBI racial mapping. The FBI has decided that it's going to engage in profiling on steroids. Rather than investigate an individual who has shown criminal activity, the FBI is investigating entire communities. So they're investigating all of the mosques in Northern California. They're investigating all black radicals in Georgia. They're investigating the entire Latino community in a program they call racial mapping. And we're educating Congress about that form, that devious, ineffective form of racial profiling that is both unconstitutional and ineffective. We fight for people who have been locked up without charge for a decade in Guantanamo Bay, or even in the United States. In just the past month, ACLU lobbyists have met with key members of the House Armed Services Committee in an effort to end indefinite detention, under the National Defense Authorization Act. We fight torture. And there's torture that has taken place at Guantanamo, but there's also torture that has taken place in the LA County Jail. And recently we won a major injunction to reform the system in LA County Jail that allowed the guards to witness inmates being tortured by their colleagues. We fight for cyber privacy and an open internet. We fight for women who make 3/4 of the money that men make, and if you're a woman of color, you make even less. We fight cruel and racist laws like the Arizona immigration measure, one that has been copycatted in 4 other states, that literally forces police to check immigration status solely because someone is a person of color. I can't tell you how many people along the borders of the United States from the ACLU affiliates have told me about the cases they are bringing on behalf of US citizens who look Latino who are being picked up and deported by the Border Patrol. It's a crisis at our borders. So we're busy in Washington. And again, why do we fight these fights? Because we care about people more than politics. We care about basic constitutional rights more than compromise. We believe in the rule of law and justice, not in personalities. We believe that a free people will always, eventually, make the right decision. But I have to end by talking about Maine. I can't stress enough how important the state and the ACLU of Maine are for our national work. From a political perspective, the Maine congressional delegation has always entertained ACLU lobbyists, even if they haven't always agreed with us. I really miss George Mitchell in times like these. Susan Collins has given us many challenges. Olympia Snow has been a little more receptive. Your House delegation has been more receptive. But it's important that we lobby Maine because so many of your congressional representatives serve on important committees. But it's from the perspective of advocacy that my hat really comes off to all of you up here. I want to talk about marriage equality for a second. My parents, a longstanding African-American family in Baltimore, there was a sister of my father's who's the oldest living American in Canada, She is 108. She's a nun. She was not allowed to join the nun, the Episcopal nunnery in Baltimore because they were segregated. And so she joined the one in Canada, and she had to flee Baltimore because she was caught making out with a woman. And so we've always talked in our family about the importance of recognizing gay and lesbian rights. And so my entire adult life, I've been working on these issues. And so earlier this year, I shot a video with my brother Billy urging Marylanders for Marriage Equality. It's hard, it's my home state. We recently got a bill through the legislature in Maryland pushing for marriage equality. And we testified brother and sister before the House of Delegates for marriage equality. So speaking from the heart, I just want to recognize the ACLU of Maine's efforts to support the 2012 Marriage Equality Ballot Initiative. That's huge. So thank you. The fact that you helped gather more than 100,000 signatures for more than 450 towns and cities throughout the state in support of this initiative is huge. Your efforts gathering volunteers, spreading the word, changing minds, have moved this state dramatically. Polls were certainly close in 2009 when the anti-equality ballot measure passed by only 53%, but the shift just in the past 2 months has been astounding. In March, polling put support for the Marriage Equality Initiative here at 53%. This month, it's at 58%. Hats off to all of you. That means that more than one out of every two folks you stop on the street believes that you have the right to marry who you love. That's you. That's the ACLU of Maine's work. Your work was also central in protecting same-day voter registration in Maine, which is a crucial ingredient in the constitutional guarantee of one person, one vote. More states should be like Maine. Maine leads the nation in participatory democracy. Measures like the same-day registration literally boost voter turnout by 10%, and that's just one of the ways the state is a pioneer. I should also note that the ballot measure reinstating same-day registration passed by almost 60%. And that's not just a referendum on a bad law, that's a popular landslide. So congratulations to you. Finally, I need to give you a shout out on your outstanding work to limit solitary confinement. The National Prison Project, which is based in the same building that I'm in Washington, has currently an initiative underway, Stop Solitary. And some of the National Prison Project stories that have been collected are just heart-rending. One of the testimonials by a prisoner named Robert King captures it best. When you're in solitary confinement, he said, the soul cries and the brain shrinks. When you are in that cell, your brain is automatically shrinking and everything shrinks with it. And I think that's lasting. Robert's statement just shows how a natural solitary confinement can be. We are social animals, and that doesn't go away when you go to jail. So now the National Prison Project is recognizing the state of Maine as an example of reform for the nation. Through the efforts of this affiliate, Maine's solitary confinement population has dropped by more than 70%. Let me repeat that, more than 70%. And so you should be proud of that too. That's huge. So again, that's your work, that's your dedication, that's your commitment, and each and every one of the people in this room getting up in the morning and going to sleep in the evening, thinking and planning and giving and working on these issues. That's important. That is each and every one of the people in this room, not just taking some action, but being an activist. That is each and every one of the people in this room living the reality that hope only comes from people who believe in principle and people who believe in action. We must rely on each other to sustain that hope today and to turn it into positive social change tomorrow. I just want to say, I thank you, Maine, so much for your work. I thank you for your commitment. I thank Anthony for allowing me to substitute for him, and I thank you for inviting me. Congratulations to you.
Thanks very much, Laura. Tell Anthony we didn't need him. You were great. I want you to imagine that leaving tonight's dinner after a nice meal and maybe a glass of wine, you get in your car and head home. And you're driving safely. The effect of the wine has long since worn off. Or maybe it hasn't. But you're abiding all, you're following all traffic laws, you're not speeding, you're not driving erratically. Your car's operating just fine, there are no lights out, your rear tail lights are working fine, your blinker is working fine. When you make a left or right-hand turn, you make an appropriate signal. And an officer pulls up behind you, blue light on, and stops you. And he comes up to your car and he asks you, have you seen somebody drive by in a red sedan? And it turns out the cop was chasing somebody with a red sedan and lost him. And because you were in the same vicinity, he thought you could provide him with some help. He then asks you, have you been drinking? He gives you a field sobriety test, decides that you have been drinking, and you're arrested. That's what happened to Ronald LaPlante, and it was wrong. Walt McKee agreed to step in along with the ACLU of Maine to defend Mr. LaPlante's Fourth Amendment right. Now, let's be clear. What Mr. LaPlante, this is not about whether or not you should be able to drink too much and drive home. That was not what this was all about. And that's not what we and Walt McKee were defending. You shouldn't drink and drive. It was about whether police need a suspicion of criminal behavior before they can stop you or detain you. They do. Walt took the case and argued that law enforcement should not be able to stop you first and then go on a fishing expedition to find evidence of wrongdoing. And that's what they did with Mr. LaPlante. Maine's law court agreed. Walt argued the case with precious little precedent from any other place, and his arguments were so eloquent and compelling that Mr. LaPlante received a unanimous decision from the law court, establishing the clear precedent upholding the Fourth Amendment's fundamental right that citizens and residents of Maine are free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, Walt combines a passionate sense of justice with legendary work ethic, rising before dawn. Walt's tireless advocacy on literally hundreds of criminal justice bills as chair of the Maine's Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, a legislative committee, has had a deep and lasting impact on civil liberties in our state. Walt often takes unpopular positions on controversial issues because it's the right thing to do. And as a criminal defense attorney, Walt is in the forefront of protecting the fundamental rights protected by the Fourth Amendment. Criminal defense attorneys defend people accused of crimes, people who are not popular. But criminal defense attorneys, such as Walt, are on the firing line of defending our fundamental Fourth Amendment rights. And it's not just the volume of what Walt does, it's how he does it. For those of us in this room, myself included, who have run the gauntlet of the legislature, Walt's individual impact is truly impressive. At a time when lawmakers are more interested, unfortunately, in appearing tough on crime than in respecting civil rights or providing real solutions to crime and over-incarceration, Walt provides an invaluable service and an invaluable voice for an opposing point of view. Whether opposing mandatory minimum sentencing or supporting privacy protections for minors merely accused of crimes, Walt's strong, rational point of view changes mind and changes minds of the legislature. On the civil side, Walt and I share a common practice. We represent professionals who are licensed by professional licensing boards. For a number of years, those of us who have practiced in that area have been concerned about the way in which those licensing agencies practice and the fact that they fail to provide due process to the individuals that are regulated. The licensing boards act as investigators, prosecutors, judges, and juries, and there is frankly no due process in those proceedings. About a year ago, the legislature was persuaded about that this was an issue of concern and directed the Commissioner of Professional and Financial Regulation to hold a series of hearings to make an inquiry as to whether or not what the problems were. Of all the lawyers who would privately express concerns, Walt was one of the few who stepped forth publicly to participate in every one of those proceedings and to join in his to express their similar concerns. He did so in a forum where it was before the very agencies before which he had to practice. And he knew that it was not a receptive forum, and he knew that it could have adverse consequences for his practice. But Walt frankly had the guts to do the right thing. In addition to his impressive legal and legislative work, Walt excels in all roles: husband, father, veteran, volunteer, legislative advocate, coach, classical violinist, outdoor and sports enthusiast, licensed pilot, TV show host, and historical builder and decorator. No matter what he's doing, Walt's intelligence, depth of expertise, clear understanding and respect for constitutional rights, succinct and humorous style, tact and courage combine to make him a force to be reckoned with. We are proud to make Walt McKee our 2012 Lewis Skolnick Award winner, and I am personally proud to present the award to him. Walt McKee. Walt, we're proud to present you with this clock from Thomas Mosier, so that you'll never again be late for court. Not that you are, but.
Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate that. I don't get introduced very often, except when I'm in a criminal jury trial. And that usually comes after the prosecutor has gone through all the terrible things that my client has done, and the judge looks at me and says, "Mr. McKee, would you like to give an opening statement?" And all I can do is suppress those words, which are, "You think?" I'm also going to steal a line from Justice Clifford, since he's here. I guess I can do that. And it's especially apt because my folks are here tonight. I very much appreciate that introduction. I'm sure my father enjoyed it, and I'm sure my mother believed all of it. When I was growing up, on the weekends in the summertime, we would listen to an old radio show. And it would always come about a few minutes before noon. And it was a great old show, and it was still on actually for many years until just a few years ago. And my brothers and sister and I would listen to these stories, and they were always great stories. They were stories about people or events, and they always kind of played the same way. It's really masterful storytelling. Garrison Keillor once described this person as a great story teller, but terrible in the politics. And you'll know who I'm talking about in a minute. But they followed the same course, and the story kind of developed, and you knew it was going to happen because this was a person that's being described as somebody who at 18 talk show attempts and failed at every one of them miserably, who had somebody who developed a manufacturing process that was ridiculous, was never going to work, or somebody that was a diehard animal rights activist throughout their entire life. And as the story is spun out, you know where it's going to go in the end. You know it is until about 30 seconds before, and the timing was beautiful, when that person would come on and they would give you one more fact, one more extra piece of information, that little bit of extra information, and then you did like we all did, and you said, "Oh my God." And then, of course, he would come on and say, "And now you know the rest of the story." Let me give you one of those rest of the stories that I think is particularly apt for tonight. really for the person that's involved more than anything else. And then I'll explain why I think this rest of the story is important. And I'll just read it right out. I won't be able to do it in that voice that we all know so well. It was Malibu in June. The weather was gray and cold and windy. Not at all what Bob and his family had hoped for when the friend invited them to his beachfront home. But Bob had promised his two young sons to swim in the ocean, and that, rain or shine, they would have. The first order of business that morning was a sandcastle for three-year-old Max. Dad left to watch the boy gathering wet sand in his tiny hands. "Do it this way," said Dad. And before long, as fathers do, he had taken over the project, and little Max sat spellbound observing. And then the wind whipped up. David, boy of 12, eager to swim. "Stay close," said Dad, but David had already started splashing out, deaf with enthusiasm. Dad waded in. The water was chilly, but the surf caressed him soothingly. He had desperately needed this respite, to spend some time romping with the boys, to ponder nothing more ponderous than an eternity of water stretched out before him. He could almost see the western horizon now through the leaden sky, and the surf surged more powerfully. From his daydream, Bob suddenly awakened to the distant sound of a voice calling for Dad. He glanced back at the beach. Little Max was still preoccupied with the sandcastle, but then Bob's eyes darted seaward. Son David, a minute before only arm's length away, was now a bobbing dot in the rolling gray. "Dad," the boy called out more urgently. This time, in an instant, Bob knew what had happened. Undertow. Young David had paddled about happily, then realized he was being drawn quickly away from the shore. He had struggled against the current, but the more he did, the stronger it became. A few minutes more, and he would be all but unreachable in the open sea. Dad plunged into the surf. In 20 feet, he could feel as though something huge and invisible were inhaling him. He swam harder. David was thrashing about in panic. Dad hollered, "Hold on, I'm almost there." And with one hand, he reached out and grabbed the flailing boy. It took all of Dad's might to fight the undertow with David clinging to him, but he fought it and he won. And when they pulled themselves from the water, David looked at his father. He said, "I'm sorry, Dad." There was a bloody bruise over Bob's right eye. "Don't mention it," Dad answered, smiling, and nobody did. And neither would we, except that only hours later, that very evening, something unforeseen and terrible happened, and Dad never came home again. For destiny has its own undertow, an irresistible undertow, and yet on the way to his own grave, Dad managed to reach out to his son with a parting gift of life itself, an indelible memory which you now share. To this day, some 44 years later, the world recalls what happened that night of June 5, 1968 at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, when an assassin named Sirhan Sirhan gunned down, shot to death the father, the dad, named Bobby Kennedy, who that morning had saved his own son's life. But now you know about that morning on the beach and the until now uncelebrated rescue at Malibu, because now you know the rest of the story. We're all kind of in the rest of the story business here. As criminal defense lawyers or civil justice advocates or those who promote civil liberties, and I think that's pretty much everybody in this room, we're all really in the same boat because it's very rare we're going out and saying we need to expand these liberties, we need to do more to make things in a way that is more free. We're always on the defensive, and we're always telling the rest of the story. And the criminal justice system is really notorious for this. I mean, the hue and cry of lock them up and throw away the key, increase the sentences because these people need to be punished is very easy. It's kind of fun sometimes to pretend I'm doing it. I think I'm very effective. I could probably get life sentences across the board, but it's easy to do that. And it's easy to do that because people respond to that. That's something that we all feel inside. That when people do bad things, they need to be punished and put away so we don't have to deal with them anymore. There's something very visceral about that. But the reality and the rest of the story is that that's a feeling that we have in the United States. It's kind of unique. We incarcerate, and sitting in jail right now, 753 out of every 100,000 people. And that kind of sounds small until you do the math and you figure out that in America, sitting right now in jail, there's more than 2 million people just sitting in jail. Now, you compare that to England, it's about 20% of that, closer to 155 out of 100,000. Germany, 90 out of 100,000. Pakistan, right? 40 out of 100,000. The United States has 5% of the world population, but we have 25% of the world prison population. Maine is considered, we just saw this in the news the other day, the safest state, and yet we have the lowest prison population. And when I mentioned that to a reporter, they said, well, maybe it's just the way those numbers go. But if you think about that, we do pretty darn well as a safe state with so very few people that are actually in jail. The hue and cry in the legislature is to make everything a felony, I mean, a mandatory minimum sentence. And as Zach and Alicia and I have joked over time, and many of us in the criminal defense community, that by 2050, every crime will be a felony with a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years. It's unfortunate because it's very difficult to ratchet that down politically. And to go up there and do the work that has been done, I'm very proud to do, because I'm very convinced that, frankly, if we weren't up there, that would just happen. It would happen very easily, kind of unanimously. The problem is that those people that are serving those sentences, and I say those people because I hear about all the time, those people need to go to jail. We don't need those people doing those things, are not the people that you might call the creepers, as my kids might call them, you know, driving around in the white van, you know, stringy hair. T-shirt, you know. They're actually what I often call pretty ordinary people involved in really extraordinary things. That by and large, they're, unfortunately, whether you like it or not, they're your neighbors, they're your friends, they're your family members, they're the people that you went to high school with. They're kind of regular, ordinary people that are sitting in jail longer and longer in the United States every single day. This is a problem that's not getting better. It is only getting worse. You know, the same goes with the civil justice system as well. You know, we often hear the United States is the most litigious society, that we have runaway juries, huge verdicts, and so on. As a plaintiff's lawyer, I'd like to have a few of those runaway juries. I mean, God bless them. Right? We don't have that many in Maine. That's kind of the reality in the rest of the story there, too, which is that in states where tort reform has been enacted, those caps on damages and other things designed to take control of those massive verdicts, none of which we see in Maine, at least with any regularity, that the insurance rates for medical professionals there are actually higher than in the state of Maine. Remember, in Maine, we had some tort reform of our own many years ago, adding pre-litigation screening panels, an extra layer of a process if you're going to bring an action against a medical professional. Something that actually has ended up having a significant downside to those who are injured as a result of medical negligence, because if a physician commits a small amount of negligence, if the victim comes and speaks to me, it's very difficult to take that case on, because I don't have to try that case once. I've got to try it twice. So that $20,000 or $30,000, if you're lucky, advancing that money in a case, a medical malpractice case, you've got to do that twice over, because you've got to go all the way through a screening panel system. And then after, if you've survived that, then to go on from there. Now, civil liberties fare no better. I mean, let's be honest here. There are many myths out there, that I would call them. We hear this, that immigrants are a drain on our social services. I mean, the classic one. Everybody knows that. I mean, they come here, they're on welfare, and so on. But the reality is, the true numbers are, in fact, this comes from a 1997 study, and it was recently affirmed in a 2007, note the date, the 2007 National Research Council of Economic Advisors report, that the reality is, by paying taxes and Social Security, this is the rest of the story, immigrants contribute far more to government coffers than they do than they use in social services. The same goes with the impact on the economy and wages of citizens that take jobs away from citizens. It simply doesn't happen. The rest of the story is that, in fact, they have a positive effect on the American economy and a whole on the income of native-born workers, again confirmed by the President's own Council of Economic Advisors. And on the civil liberties end, we often hear, at least in the modern media, the Patriot Act, pretty sure it's going all right. We're not really seeing a whole lot of abuses. And when I read that, I just get livid. And the first thing I think of is, how's that working out for Brandon Mayfield? That's a name we haven't heard for a while. That was about 8 years ago in 2004. Brandon was an attorney out in the West Coast, former U.S. Army officer, was arrested, held for over 30 days after previously having had his house searched without a warrant, his phones bugged without a warrant, and accused of bombing a train in Madrid, right? I mean, hey, this is a pretty major action. The problem there is he hadn't even been out of the United States in a dozen years, and fingerprint evidence, which the government was shown as being inaccurate from day one, was disregarded, and he was held there. And that the rest of the story there was he just wasn't anywhere near the place, not to mention he was completely not guilty. So I am very grateful for this honor because I like to tell a little bit of the rest of the story in my regular work. I tell people I really never kind of sought out, you know, this mission. It's kind of just the way it went. When I got out of law school and started practicing law, it just seemed like the right thing to do at the time, and I just kind of kept doing it and doing it, and it's been very enjoyable for me. But just as these causes have the rest of the story, I've got a little rest of the story too, because, you know, we are a product of all that we meet, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank at least a few people tonight. My wife, Kirsten, many of you know, works at the Disability Rights Center with Helen Bailey and Kim Moody, and she is truly an inspiration. I'm getting this award here, but she is one who works each day, every day, all day, on behalf of people with disabilities, and does just tremendous work. And I get up early in the morning, but you know what? Sometimes the light is on downstairs, and that's because she got up before I did to do the work that is done there, and it is truly great work. My daughters are here tonight, and they are a great inspiration to me. They're looking down because they don't want to look up at their dad right now. I won't say any more. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of legend and myth with respect to the early morning stuff. Did it come from the Army or growing up on a farm? But my sister's in the audience, and she'll chuckle at this because my folks are both teachers, and my mother was a teacher for many years at Winthrop School System. In fact, she just got called back to do some work. The teacher quit in the middle of the year, and the school was kind of in a jam. My mother's long since retired, and they called her back in. And I kind of liken this to, like, you know, the school is like, oh my God, we lost a teacher. And then all of a sudden, the 82nd Airborne came in because Linda McKee was back. But the story is that I remember distinctly, and my sister will as well, that oftentimes the last words at night, you know, after a good night, were my mother turning to my father and say, Bob, set the alarm for 4 a.m. Because she wanted to do the great work that she did. And certainly my dad has been a huge part of my life. I've never been prouder. I practice in Kennebec County, and I invariably run into all kinds of different people who will say, oh, I know you from somewhere, and I'll think it's from TV show or some big case I had, or they were on a jury that loved me, and they say, oh, no, I know you. You're Bob McKee's kid. And I'm actually never prouder than when that is said, because I love my dad, and I'm really a product of a lot of what he taught me. And still teaches me to this day. I had some great mentors over the year. Many of you are in here. I wish I could mention them all, but two stand out in particular. Mal Lyons is here, and Mal and I have worked on cases, especially over the last 10 years together, and has been a real inspiration to me, a true professional to the very end. I often think about how I might respond or do something in a case, and I really do kind of think, I think Mal would do it a certain way, and that's the way I want to do it. And the same goes with Roger Cates, who came and probably has already left. And Roger was a partner of mine at Lippman, Cates, and McKee for many years. And I was always a great patron saint to me. And anybody who knows Roger loves Roger. And Roger is the person, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, is the great person all the way through to the end of the day. And was just always a very positive person who just always truly did the right thing. I have so many great colleagues here tonight who do great work. Lenny Sharon, Dan Lilly, Jay was, I'm not sure if Jay Sweet came tonight as well. Jody Knopfsinger's here. So many great lawyers that I look to and I respect and I try to be like sometimes because I know that they're doing the right thing. But there's a few other people here, and they're really the ACLU of Maine people that I'm just blown away by. And I've told Shanna this, and I'm not, you know, trying to pump them up for a big raise, but I've worked with Alicia and Zach, and I'm just struck by the quality of people that you have up there. You know, Alicia and I are often just Alicia and I up there, you know, two of us against the 20, you know, groups with our little fists in the air. And whenever they say, does anybody oppose this bill, they always look over there, and sure enough, up we go. And, you know, you can do these things a lot of different ways, and I've seen it, you know, some people speak before these committees, but I think that Alicia and I have really just tried to be very professional, honest, tell the truth, and really give the rest of the story day in and day out up there. And that in the end, as much as I don't agree with everything that happens up there, in the end, when people get the rest of the story, they understand that, they appreciate that, and by and large, they usually do the right thing. So thank you very much for this award and allowing me to speak tonight.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today we heard the annual Justice Louis Skolnick Award from the Maine chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. The award recipient and speaker was Walt McKee, the principal attorney of McKee Law of Augusta. The program also featured Laura Murphy, lead lobbyist for the ACLU of Washington, D.C. Sheena Bellows, executive director of the ACLU of Maine, introduced Laura Murphy, and attorney John Patterson, president of the ACLU, introduced Walt McKee. They recently spoke in Freeport. You can also listen to this program again at your convenience by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.